Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said yesterday the president is not considering a strategy in which the U.S. would withdraw troops from Afghanistan. The administration is presently reviewing a request from the top U.S. general there for thousands of additional troops. Some are calling for a change in approach from a counterinsurgency to a counterterrorism operation. Joining me for the debate over next steps for U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan, former CIA analyst Paul Pillar, retired General James Dubik, and Wall Street Journal national security correspondent Peter Spiegel. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Joining us now by phone is Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981. He and Brent Scowcroft are the authors of America and the World. Dr. Brzezinski, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you.
Do you believe that the U.S. is headed down the same road as the Soviet Union in regard to Afghanistan?
The word believe might be too strong, but I'm concerned that we might be. And the way I would put it is this. When the Russians went into Afghanistan, within a year, most Afghans viewed them as invaders and opposed them fervently for 8 years and eventually defeated the Russians. When we went into Afghanistan some 8 years ago after 9/11, most Afghans were on our side, in part because we helped them against the Soviets. We defeated the Taliban and overthrew it with 300 special forces and air power. 8 years later, we now have 60,000 troops in Afghanistan. There are plans, perhaps, for increasing it to even 100,000. Doesn't that tell you something about what is happening in Afghanistan?
Does that mean you do not support sending more troops?
I would put it a little more, in a more qualified fashion. You know, there may be specific reasons why more troops are needed for this or that objective.
40,000?
Well, that's the question. If, for example, we need more troops to prevent a town from falling because we don't have enough troops, if we need to deploy some more troops to control roads, I can see that. I am personally skeptical about 40,000 troops to make for a more effective counterinsurgency, because that eight-year trend, which I just described to you, namely, we now have to have 60,000 troops, even though we were welcomed when we came in with 300, indicates that if we build up, we may unintentionally even create more resistance to ourselves, because we'll be increasingly viewed as invaders, as foreigners, and not as friends.
Would you then go back to the idea of a counterterrorism operation rather than a counterinsurgency operation?
I would not like to reduce that to a single slogan. I think we have to have a combination of some counterinsurgency, particularly in areas where it is strategically threatening, that is to say, has the potential for cutting major communication lines, has the potential for establishing a major base, not just for the Taliban, but potentially for Al-Qaeda, has the potential for taking some towns. I think counterinsurgency in that respect is necessary. But it's not the whole story. I think in the long run, it is the Afghans themselves who have to resolve the internal conflict. And all indications allegedly suggest that most Afghans are not in favor of the Taliban. We don't have to spend years building up the Afghan army. Let me ask you this. Who trains the Taliban? How come they fight so well? The Afghans don't need training from us if they want to fight the Taliban. Beyond that, we have to have a political strategy. We have to be willing to make some local accommodations, even with local Taliban.
All right, and one final question. If indeed the U.S. does send 40,000 or some number of thousands of additional troops to Afghanistan, how long do you believe the U.S. will be in Afghanistan?
It could be for years and years. It all depends on whether sending in more troops resolves the issue quickly, which I doubt, or whether it builds up more Afghan resistance against us, which I fear. And if it is the latter, we're going to be there for a very, very long time. And we have already been there for 8 years.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, he was National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. Good to talk with you.
It's good to talk to you, Diane. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, turning to you, Paul Pillar, same question for you. Is the U.S. headed down the same path as the Russians in Afghanistan?
I think President Obama is painfully aware of some of the truths that Dr. Brzezinski just spoke of. He is also very aware of what else he wants to accomplish in the next 3 years and the next 7 years.
Do you mean there or domestically?
I mean domestically and everything else, from healthcare,
okay.
You name it. And just looking back not only to the experience of the Soviets in the 80s, but, of course, the much-discussed now experience of the United States in Vietnam in the 60s and what that did to President Johnson's plans. I think the president, President Obama, is genuinely undecided at this point. I think the White House is sincere when they say we are looking at this carefully. We are going to have more meetings of the president's senior advisors, but I also think he is painfully conscious of the hazards that Dr. Brzezinski rightly pointed out.
Turning to you, General Dubik, is Defense Secretary Gates supporting General McChrystal, or is he undecided as well?
Well, I don't know, Diane, specifically whether he personally is undecided or not, but I think his call for candor and complete openness in the discussion among the senior advisors of President Obama is exactly right. And General McChrystal's report to Secretary Gates lays out the best military advice from General McChrystal's perspective. Of course, the president has to decide all things considered, not just best military advice. And the kind of discussion that's going on now among the president's senior advisors is exactly the right discourse from which I believe the best course of action will ultimately emerge.
And Peter Spiegel, you've been writing about this for some time. Is there a split between National Security Advisor Jim Jones and General McChrystal?
I'm not sure if that's where the split is, but there certainly is a split within the president's closest advisors over the way forward. As General Dubik mentioned, we do have General McChrystal's report, which is very assertive that we need a fully resourced, manpower-intensive counterinsurgency, tens of thousands of additional troops. That is backed by General Petraeus, his boss, and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. On the other hand, we have what has come to be known as the Biden camp, after Vice President Joe Biden, who argues, as you said in your intro, for this much more narrowly focused counterterrorism. Go after al-Qaeda using drones, special forces, not a drawdown necessarily, but not the kind of increase that General McChrystal is talking about. Now, in that camp, we've seen people like Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff. There is some people on Richard Holbrooke's staff, who's the special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan from the U.S., who've argued that you can separate the Taliban from al-Qaeda. We've seen a real degradation of al-Qaeda over the last 7 years, despite the fact the Taliban has regained areas in Afghanistan. Why don't we just do it that way? That's the debate that's really, really playing out right now. General Jones has frankly kept his cards pretty close to his vest, as has Secretary Gates. And I think you're right to point to Secretary Gates as perhaps a key member of this decision-making process. He's gained a lot of credibility within the White House. He's gained a lot of credibility on Capitol Hill, and I think he's going to be the key voice in this decision-making process.
Help me to understand what is meant by separating the Taliban from al-Qaeda in terms of real action.
Well, this is probably the key point of the debate right now. There's a Barnett Rubin, who is an advisor to Richard Holbrooke, has written about this quite extensively, and I think he's been the most articulate on this matter. And he has argued this. The Taliban learned their lesson after September 11th. They had Afghanistan. They controlled Afghanistan. And they lost it because they allied with al-Qaeda. They're not going to make the same mistake twice. Now, I have talked to many people, both in the Pentagon and elsewhere, who say although this view is being articulated rather forcefully, it is still a very minority view. That most in the military, including, frankly, Secretary Gates, who last night at an event here in Washington, basically said that he believed that return of Taliban would mean more area for al-Qaeda to regroup. So it's a minority view, but it is a view that's being argued rather forcefully.
And yet, Senator McCain said this morning on the Today program, you cannot separate the Taliban from al-Qaeda.
And I think that is the received wisdom, I think, within the military. I mean, look, these are two organizations that have a long, storied history together. They fought together and have their roots in the Mujahideen in the 80s. They've closely associated themselves. Others, some of the extremist leaders in the Fatah, the Pakistani tribal areas, Hekmatyar, Haqqani, some of these guys, longtime Mujahideen fighters who have allied themselves with al-Qaeda in the past. The belief, again, according to many of these people in the military, is the ability to separate these two is really not doable.
Peter Spiegel, he's national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a short break. I'd like to hear from you. I want to know what your thinking is. Let's hear your views. Welcome back. As we talk about the administration's development of strategy, new thinking in regard to Afghanistan, you've already heard Zbigniew Brzezinski with his thoughts here in the studio, Paul Pillar at Georgetown University, former CIA National Intelligence Officer, General James Dubik, former commander of the Multinational Security Transition in Command in Iraq. He's senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War, a former advisor to General McChrystal, and Peter Spiegel. He's senior national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. The question of time seems to come up in a lot of people's minds. Here's an email from Bobby in Syracuse who says, I applaud President Obama for his thoughtful approach to this situation. Not much thinking went into the invasion of Iraq, and look where that has taken us. General Dubik, what is your view about this length of time calling in various advisors?
No, thank you, Diane. The comment is exactly right. A thoughtful approach is exactly what is required. Certainly it is the case that the Taliban has made some inroads, has some initiative, and we must at one point wrest that initiative from them. But until we can set clear objectives for ourselves, identify with relative clarity what strategy the American people will support and what strategy will have the highest probability of success, the discussion of resources should really be delayed. And a strategic discussion of this consequence is something that you want to have up front, not afterwards.
So that bringing in Vice President Biden's view, bringing in Secretary of State Clinton's view, bringing in the whole group of top advisors and not just the military is what President Obama is doing. How successfully, Peter?
Well, I must say there is some nervousness amongst the military about the length of this. I mean, in General McChrystal's assessment, he says we have about 12 months to turn this thing around. If you delay, I mean, this process is probably going to go on for a month, month and a half. Now, that seems like a short period of time to develop, as General Dubek says, a comprehensive strategy that has the support of the American public. But when you're dealing on the ground with an insurgency that's gaining strength and has momentum and is gaining strength among the population in Afghanistan, you're getting a sense of urgency out of the field.
And 8 people killed over the weekend.
Exactly. And the war is not going in the right direction. It continues not to go in the right direction. So there is a sense of urgency in the military, and you do hear some concern and frustration in the Pentagon about the fact that this is a re-debate of a debate that happened back in February, March timeframe.
Paul Pillar, a re-debate?
Well, the listener is quite correct in drawing a big contrast between the Iraq War and the current war. I'm not too impressed by the arguments that, well, we don't have enough time, we've got to rush to a decision. Recall that one of the things the president already did was to increase the troop level as a kind of stopgap, pending further review. And a lot of things have happened since the policy that was enunciated in March. And the big thing that's often been pointed out is the Afghan election, which was disappointingly, blatantly corrupt. And other things have happened as well. So I think the White House is doing exactly the right thing. I should point out that this kind of deliberate process, it's necessary to arrive at a sound policy. It's not sufficient. You can look back again to the Vietnam era of the 1960s when the Johnson administration looked to be doing things just as painstakingly, just as carefully, but there were certain unstated, unquestioned underlying assumptions about the domino theory, about U.S. credibility that did not get examined.
Is that in existence today?
Well, I don't know what's being said inside the sit room, but I would hope that in addition to all the strictly strategic questions of how many troops to accomplish what mission, the more basic assumptions about is stabilization of Afghanistan essential or important enough to U.S. interests to justify the cost that the strategy would require. That's the kind of underlying define the mission question that the president has to decide, not just what's the right strategy.
And you talked about the defining the mission, General Dubek. What would General McChrystal do with these additional troops?
Well, in the beginning of his report, he outlines what President Obama has described as his objectives: disrupt and dismantle and eventually defeat al-Qaeda and prevent al-Qaeda from returning. And Paul's exactly right. There are a set of assumptions about what is necessary to reach that goal. And there are a range of options to reach that goal, from the comprehensive counterinsurgency that General McChrystal suggested, and quite frankly, I support, at one side, and a more limited counterterrorist, which I believe is necessary but insufficient, on the other side. And there's a range in between. The discussion among the seniors really, I think, ought to be what are the strategic alternatives that can accomplish that mission?
Such as?
Number one, can counterterrorists alone do the job? Can we just accelerate the Afghan National Security Forces and transfer to them? Can we figure out some power-sharing relationship with the Taliban? Is there a way to make a agreement or some kind of arrangement with the warlords? So these are alternative ways that we ought to really examine. Again, my personal belief is that when it's all said and done and the argument is over, the option with the highest probability of success, and that's all we're talking about here, is probabilities of success and degrees of risk, is a comprehensive counterinsurgency campaign.
But, Peter, don't the civilian advisors have a totally different view from those in the military of what those goals would be and how to achieve them?
I'm not sure my reporting shows that. I think this is largely a minority view within the civilian advisors that is looking at this more narrowly focused counterterrorism strategy. I mean, again, I think we always circle back to Secretary Gates. Secretary Gates expressed some of the very same reservations that Dr. Brzezinski expressed at the top of the show about, are we becoming the Soviet Union? And he expressed those for months earlier this year. He has gradually pulled back. He has said, I'm open now to new troops, and actually again last night said one of the problems we have had in Afghanistan is never having enough troops. We and our allies under-resourced this. So I think you're seeing Secretary Gates, who is the key civilian in all this, move in the direction of General McChrystal, and I think that's going to be the key swing vote here.
What would happen, in your view, Paul Pillar, if the U.S. decided it's time to get out?
Well, a withdrawal... getting out from today is simply not politically in the cards. I mean, Robert Gibbs, I think, made that clear yesterday. What we would be talking about in terms of the low end of the options that are politically realistic is something like what we're facing in Iraq today, you know, a timetable for drawing down our current presence over roughly the next couple of years, while putting, if anything, increased emphasis on economic assistance, assisting the regime to build up its own forces and so on. What would happen? The Afghans would go about doing business the way they've usually gone about business, making deals, making fresh deals among themselves as they see the power equation changing. I think Dr. Brzezinski has some very useful things to say, as we've heard from others, about making accommodation with elements of what are identified as Taliban, but the Taliban is far from a unified organization. That would be part of the deal-making. It's really the Afghan way of doing things.
What kinds of accommodations are we talking about?
We're talking about understandings between whoever is still in power in Kabul, be it President Karzai or someone else, and local warlords or militia heads with regard to, all right, you control that province or that district, but you're not going to cause larger problems outside that province or district. And there would be other understandings with regard to customs duties and all that sort of thing.
I mean, I would just point out that very thought is in General McChrystal's assessment. I mean, he writes rather eloquently that every counterinsurgency ends with accommodation with the enemy. Now, it is not likely to be the Mullah Omars and the leadership of the Taliban that are now running the Taliban out of Quetta, but there are low to mid-level Taliban who are largely tribal leaders in the Pashtun areas that will have to be accommodated. It's the only way to end an insurgency. This is what happened in Iraq, where you had members of some of the Shia militias integrated into the government forces, where you had some of the insurgents in the Sunni heartland in Anbar province brought into the Sons of Iraq program. There always has to be some sort of accommodation with this insurgents. And General McChrystal sort of predicts that and says that is necessary to end this war.
General Dubik, how do you, in the face of U.S. and other soldiers dying, how do you bring about the support of the U.S. population?
Well, I think the first thing is to decide to be committed to a strategy that we think has a high probability of success.
Do you think the American people are there yet?
I don't think they're there yet. I think we need some more leadership to explain why we are where we are after 8 years of war, and explanation of the strategic choice that the nation makes and why the leadership believes that this strategic choice has a high probability of success. No one wants to send his son or daughter or brother to war against a strategy that has a low probability of success. And so this debate, again, I think is a very healthy debate to have, to make a choice as a nation, to select a course of action and commit to it. We saw, in terms of the Iraqi and Afghan population, a very similar phenomenon in Iraq. When end of 2006, beginning of 2007, the Iraqi population were not very happy with the coalition forces. And the reason was we weren't providing security. We weren't providing the leadership and moving the Iraqis along. As that turned middle 2007 to middle 2008, so did the perception and the support of the Iraqi people.
Where are the American people now, Peter?
Well, the polls are going in the wrong direction on this one. But I think the example of Iraq is a good one. The opposition and the polling against the war in Iraq at the height of the conflict was much worse than it is now. The American people were much more opposed to the war in Iraq than they are now in the war in Afghanistan. And the way, as General Dubik described it, the way the American people were turned around on this is you had General Petraeus go to Congress, explain to the American people why they're doing what they're doing. You had Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen do the same thing. The Obama administration hasn't really done that yet. There's been a lot of criticism from Capitol Hill about why hasn't McChrystal appeared on Capitol Hill? Why haven't you been out there speaking more about this? Now, Secretary Gates has said, look, we don't want to get General McChrystal out ahead of the president. Let's let the president get some time to make his decision, and then I'll be on the Hill, and I'll be followed by General McChrystal, and we'll explain exactly why we decided what we decided. Yeah. But they need to make that case.
Sorry.
A major handicap for anyone trying to muster the public support that you so rightly suggest is essential on this, Diane, is that the war has already been going on for 8 years. That's as long as we were fighting on the ground in Vietnam.
Paul Piller, he's visiting professor at Georgetown University at 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. First to Lansing, Michigan. Julika, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I fervently appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment that I'm an immigrant from Mexico. I was born and raised there. And President Obama is the first president that really spoke to me, that I feel really represents me, too. And I hope he continues to show the sensitivity that he showed during the campaign about how we are represented worldwide, internationally, and this theme of change for me was very important. And so I hope he continues to be different from the previous administration's imperialistic policies that were really, for someone that is not born American, just so annoying to see how the disregard for how other people perceive and experience American power and military. And I hope that President Obama and his advisors continue to bring the awareness that I heard during the campaign.
Thank you, Julika. Paul Piller.
I share Julika's hope. I think President Obama realizes that not only the sort of perceptions of him and his policy in the United States that Julika speaks of are important, but also that he had some advantages coming in as he did. He was a contrast to the previous administration. But the very issue that we're discussing this morning, the next steps on the Afghanistan war, will be a major factor in determining whether Julika's hopes are realized or not.
Let's go now to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Diane, and it's great to hear you back on the air.
Thank you.
I have a little bit of a statement and then a question that kind of rounds out. And,
sure.
And I certainly agree Afghanistan is a tough place to do battle, and I don't personally agree we should be there. But when we talk about it, we're always making it sound like the Russians were defeated by these crafty, unbeatable locals that came out of caves ready to fight. But in fact, they were defeated because we spent billions in arming them and training them and creating Osama bin Laden. And that's why they were defeated. So from that logic, unless Russia is supplying them with weapons equal to what we did, I don't think it's an impossible battle. I think the problem is that no one's really fighting us. There are no armies. We're not at war. We're simply an invading force in a country with no military. They've never attacked us in any way. So aren't we simply just fighting factions of locals who want us out of our country, and they lack a military, so they have to resort to, you know, the poor man's weapon, which is terrorism?
Thank you, Casey.
I mean, Casey's exactly right. I mean, actually, Secretary Gates, again, has made this exact point when discussing with General McChrystal about the differences between the Soviet experience and our experience. There is no CIA-backed Mujahideen in Afghanistan right now. Where I would slightly disagree with the caller is, although there is not an organized military fighting against the U.S. and its allies right now, there is a pretty organized insurgency. They do have some form of command control from the tribal regions in Pakistan. And frankly, most of the wars America has fought over its two centuries have been in counterinsurgencies. You've seen it in Vietnam. You've seen it in the Philippines. These are wars Americans have fought and frankly won in the past. And it is not, therefore, I think, analogous to say that because we're not fighting uniformed military, this is not a war that is necessarily something the United States is normally involved in.
General, dude.
No, I think it is a war. There's, in my mind, absolutely no doubt that what we're fighting is a war. It is not a war in a conventional sense, and that makes it much more difficult conceptually to explain to the American people what we're doing and why we're doing it and how long it will take to accomplish the missions.
Paul Pillar.
Casey's absolutely right, and I would just note this accentuates the concern Dr. Brzezinski raised about to what extent we are seen by various Afghans as occupiers rather than the defender against a specific enemy military force.
All right, short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. This is NPR.
Email and e-commerce are pushing the U.S. Post Office deeper into debt. Postmaster General John Potter on the future of the U.S. Postal Service in the 21st century. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Here's an email from Dan in Holland, Michigan, who says, I thought this was a NATO operation and that Obama was going to work in concert with them. Why are we only talking about the U.S. role? Peter.
It is a NATO operation. And General McChrystal is both the head of U.S. Forces Afghanistan and the head of ISAF, which is the NATO operation there. The problem is, frankly, for years, Secretary Gates went to Europe and said, hey, we need more troops. Hey, we need more troops. And they, other than the British, no one has really stepped up to the plate. And the decision basically was made, well, if we need to turn things around and we need it with more troops, there's no one else beside the Americans who are going to pony up. And that's been the realization that Gates, I think, has made over the course of his 3 years in office.
So how many British troops are there now?
There are 9,000 British troops, mostly in Helmand province, which is in the south and, frankly, the most violent area of Afghanistan, along with the Canadians who are next door in Kandahar and the Dutch who are a little bit north in Uruzgan. So there are three countries who are sending hundreds of thousands of troops to the hottest areas of Afghanistan. It's just those are not enough. I mean, even Helmand, 9,000 troops, the determination by General McChrystal is not enough to hold the ground.
And General Dubik, the Brits are not happy.
Well, the British population is not happy. Again, from all the polls, but the British Army has been a well-performing army, a dedicated army, and one that has fought pretty well in Afghanistan. And I don't know how that debate there is going to be going to play out. But the email question is exactly right. This is a NATO mission. The U.S., of course, is a member of NATO. And the leadership requirement in NATO now is to very similar to that in the United States. How do we pull together will to continue this mission that is as important to them? I mean, London was bombed, Madrid was bombed. There are all kind of terrorist cells that you can read about in open source. And the terrorists are trying to influence political affairs in NATO. So this war is not just a U.S. war. This war is very global.
And, of course, Italy has pulled its troops out.
But they're sending in Carabinieri police, which are paramilitary police, very, very proficient police, who were instrumental in turning around the national police in Iraq. And they've dedicated some increase to Afghanistan to assist the Afghan National Civil Order Police.
How many?
Similarly. I don't know the number. I think that's still in discussion.
If I could just jump in, it is worth noting that the debate we are having here, or the bomb administration is having here, is having ripple effects in Europe. Some of the things you hear from senior government leaders, not necessarily in government, but MPs and that type of thing, are saying, well, hold on a second. You've been asking for us for years to send troops, and now you're second-guessing it. Maybe we won't send additional troops. So that's starting to have ripple effects on the allies, and that's going to, I think, remain until we get a firm decision from the president.
All right. To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Janice. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Diane. We love your show.
Thank you.
A couple of things. Between the fact that the United States population in general doesn't know crap about Afghanistan or Muslim religion, well, Islam, the Muslim people, and that there are so many similarities between their religion and all our Christian religions, and even Judaism. That and things like the American population, you know, if they just sat down and watched Charlie Wilson's War and read Greg Morrison's horribly written but very informative Three Cups of Tea, they might have an inkling of an idea. Or if they sat down with a neighbor who happens to be Afghanistan, who 9 years ago lost four family members in one day, you know, and talked to these people who are our neighbors. A lot of people live here now from Afghanistan for a reason, the same reason our grandparents and great-grandparents came to this country, so that their families could survive. And the money in Afghanistan that's supporting all these horrible people killing, Afghanis, is, I think, still from Saudi Arabia. Is that not true? And, of course, we're not going to go to war with Saudi Arabia. We need their oil. And these people are so poor, they'll give their life up to clear a minefield so they can plant poppies.
All right. Thanks for calling. Paul Pillar.
Well, it's true that as far as how the American public figures into this debate, there is a lot of things that aren't understood. Most of the things that we've been talking about this morning, and I dare say with greater sophistication those in the White House sitting room are discussing, are lost to most Americans. For most Americans, it's a question of, number one, Afghanistan had something to do with 9/11, didn't it? And number two, we're losing troops and spending money there, aren't we? And it kind of comes down to that balance in a rather crude sort of way. And that's the main political backdrop that the president is going to have to consider.
Let's go now to Tony in Bloomfield, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to make a comment about the absolute necessity to help all people and all countries become free of tyranny. You know, we suffered from dating back Napoleon and Hitler, and then you can call fanatic Islam anything you want, but it's still a dictatorship. And we need freedom for all people in the world so we can secure freedom at home.
General Dubik, is freedom what the Afghanistan people want?
Well, the normal Afghanistan person wants the same thing we want, to be left alone, to be able to get a job, to raise his family, to have a relatively stable future, and not to be screwed with. This is common to each one of us as human beings. And the issue is, how do we help in this regard? And I go back to Mr. Brzezinski's comments. Yes, we can go in with 300 special forces and big bombers to destroy things, but when you shift the words that he used to prevention, to control, to establish security, these are not things you do from the air. These are things that you do on the ground.
But what about Secretary Gates' concern over the American footprint in Afghanistan and the feelings of those in that country about the American presence?
This is a very legitimate concern. The footprint should be as small as possible. But as I mentioned earlier, the perception of the Afghan people in terms of are we occupiers or are we helpers is very much a function of their feeling of security. The better security we help to provide for them with the Afghan National Security Forces and through their government, the happier they'll be with us. Right now, they're not happy because, as Peter talked, the Taliban has the initiative and is expanding. They don't want the Taliban. If they're polling numbers, the Taliban polling numbers are way lower than anybody that we're talking about, either in Europe, United States, or Afghanistan. So like we did in Iraq, as we provided better security through 2007 and 2008, you saw the Iraqi people turn in support of the coalition because they had some sense of assurity that we were staying, that we would help them, and that we could dismantle al-Qaeda with their help. But
Dr. Brzezinski also talked about the fact that he thought that the U.S. would be there for years, Paul Pillar. Oh. And one has to wonder about what that means in terms of loss of life.
Oh, absolutely. And General McChrystal's assessment didn't place a timetable on it, but I think made it clear that one should draw exactly the kind of inference Dr. Brzezinski did, that we're talking about years and probably quite a few years. And what that adds up to in terms of blood and treasure is immense.
All right, to Billings, Montana. Good morning, Rick. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the question of how we're going to fund these additional troops. But first, I wanted to state that your radio show is truly a civil service, and I appreciate your show.
Thank you so much, Rick.
You have the greatest interviews, and I would like to comment back that previously on one of your shows, you had a retired general stating that we need to get out of there, and I would call him a civilian at this time, but how are we going to fund this additional force if the president decides to go that way, and how are our allies funding it?
I think those are good questions, Peter.
I mean, it's the same old-fashioned way we spend money on everything else, appropriations process in Congress. But it is an issue that has become increasingly of concern amongst policymakers, particularly with the White House that is looking at overhauling health care and a whole bunch of other domestic issues that are going to take money. We have to find new money to surge troops into Afghanistan. It should be noted that if the president does agree to do this, it will come at the same time as a drastic drawdown in Iraq. We're going to go from about 120,000, 125,000 troops in Iraq in January to about 50,000 by August, September of next year. So we have a huge drawdown in the expense of the war in Iraq. At the same time, we would be ramping up in Afghanistan. So there is some offset there, but it will still be expensive.
Paul.
And, of course, we're trying to dig out of a hole from the stimulus program and the huge increase in the national debt already as a result of the recession.
Here's an email from Terry who says, why stay and fight if no army has ever won there? Al-Qaeda can plan or train anywhere in the world, so why fight in Afghanistan? Paul.
Al-Qaeda can plan and train anywhere in the world. And one thing we haven't underscored in our discussion so far is what we would or would not accomplish even if General McChrystal's strategy was implemented in full and he got all the troops he wanted. Look at his assessment, what it says about not taking control of, not stabilizing the entirety of Afghanistan. He acknowledges there would still be major parts of it that would be outside U.S. or allied or Kabul's control. That means even if a an al-Qaeda safe haven in Afghanistan is important, and I don't think it has the importance that it is normally deemed to, for precisely the reason the questioner mentions. There's still a lot of territory out there that will be available for that, even if the counterinsurgency is totally successful in General McChrystal's terms.
And so, again, even if al-Qaeda is crushed in Afghanistan and Pakistan, we're already seeing signs of them moving to Yemen, to Somalia. I mean, this is the issue of ungovernable spaces, and can the U.S. on its own stand up these governments and give them the capacity to fight against them, and are we going to do it all over the world?
I think the answer is the United States cannot do it alone, but what this discussion is leading to is kind of a dirty part of the war, that this is a global war that al-Qaeda is waging. The two most active theaters are Afghanistan and Iraq, Iraq diminishing, Afghanistan increasing.
But you agree that even if you got them out of Afghanistan,
they'll go somewhere else. They're already.
So why are we fighting in Afghanistan?
Because that's the theater that we have to finish before we can figure out what to do next.
Paul Pillar, I would assume, though I could be wrong, that you would be more in favor of Vice President Biden's approach.
I would, but let's clarify the terms here. I don't like this sort of counterinsurgency versus counterterrorist strategy business. Strategy is one thing. Defining the mission and deciding whether the mission is worth it is something else. So far as I know, Vice President Biden agrees totally with General McChrystal as to what would be necessary to stabilize Afghanistan.
Okay.
I suspect he, like I, questions, however, whether stabilization of Afghanistan is significant enough to protect Americans from al-Qaeda terrorism or any other terrorism to justify the enormous loss of blood and treasure that counterinsurgency would entail.
That's key. Just key. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Richard, who's in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, you know, this last comment, I think, especially shows why the discussion, much of the discussion has missed the mark. I don't think the focus should be al-Qaeda. I think the focus of what we're doing in Afghanistan should be the Taliban. If the Taliban can control a large part of Afghanistan, whether it's 40% or 60% or whatever, they're closely related to the Taliban of Pakistan, and they will put arms and men into that fight. And that fight is that's a much more dangerous situation. I think that the real focus should be the Taliban, and our objective should be to either defeat the Taliban, marginalize it, or dismantle it.
Thanks, Richard. Peter.
I think there are a lot of people in the Pentagon that agree with Richard's point. They describe these extremist groups as a syndicate. The argument is these are not necessarily discrete organizations, although many of them have different heads. They're all affiliated with each other. And while many of their goals are to strike at the United States, many of their goals are also to destabilize American allies in the region, Afghanistan and Pakistan being the most obvious ones, but also India. And is it in the U.S.'s interest to make sure that these groups in the region do not undermine the broader region? And as a result, Taliban is affiliated with these other groups.
Paul.
The Afghan Taliban are among the most insular and inward-looking groups anywhere. They are concerned, above all, with politics and society in Afghanistan. And by the way, they have received assistance, as General McChrystal said in his report, from Pakistan's own intelligence service, and reportedly still does. So if we're worried about Pakistan, that's one of the bigger paradoxes of this whole contest.
General
Duke. Yeah, I think this part of the syndicate that Peter mentioned is a really good analogy. And while the al-Qaeda is the group that attacked us on 9/11, so we ought not to forget that, they will receive, I think, a huge boost in ideological power, so to speak, if we do lose or appear to lose in Afghanistan.
Finally, all of you, where does the balance of thinking stand right now within the administration, Peter?
Ooh, that's a tough one. When I talk to people, there's still an assumption that General McChrystal will get most of what he wants. I think, you know, the administration fired his predecessor and put him in command for a reason. And they've asked him to come back with his best guess, and he has done it. And I think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt on this
General,
one.
Yeah, I would say that after the debate is done, that the comprehensive counterinsurgency strategy is most likely to succeed in terms of the strategy, but the resourcing is still an open question.
Paul Pillar.
I don't have an inside window on this. As I said before, I think the president's genuinely undecided, and beyond that, I'm going to punt.
How long do you think this process will take?
It's a matter of weeks, I think.
Weeks.
Before the end of the month, I think, is what everyone is expecting.
All right. Peter Spiegel. He's with the Wall Street Journal. Paul Pillar is at Georgetown University. General James Dubik, former commander of the Multinational Security Transition Command in Iraq. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane. Great
and
morning.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.